Jai Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari Jai Radha Jai Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari Gopi Jana Vallabha Giribhar Dhari Gopi Jana Vallabha Giribhar Dhari Yashoda Nandana Braja Jana Rajana Yashoda Nandana Braja Jana Rajana Yamati Ravana Chari Yamati Ravana Chari Jai Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari Jai Radha Jai Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari Gopi Jana Vallabha Giribhar Dhari Gopi Jana Vallabha Giribhar Dhari Yashoda Nandana Braja Jana Ranjana Yashoda Nandana Braja Jana Ranjana Jamunati Ravana Chari Jamunati Ravana Chari Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare 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 Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare 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 Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare, Hare Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare, Hare. जय श्री श्री राधा माधव की, श्री श्री किशोर किशोर की।
क्या नहीं, कंप्यूटर इज ऑन देयर मॉर्निंग, इज ऑन देयर मॉर्निंग। श्रीमद् भागवतम 4th कैंटो चैप्टर 28, पुरंजना बिकम्स अ वुमन इन द नेक्स्ट लाइफ। Today's text 46. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. यदा नोपलभेतं ग्रौ उष्मानं पत्युरर्चति आसित् संदिग्ना हृदया यूत भ्रष्ट मृगीयतः। यदा नोपलभेतं ग्रौ उष्मानं पत्युर अर्चति आसित संदिग्न हृदय यूथा भ्रष्ट मृगीयतः। Vaishnavis, yada when na not upalabheta could feel angro in the feet ushmanam heat patyuhu of her husband archati while serving asit she became samvigna anxious Ridaya at heart, Yuta Brashta, bereft of her husband. Mrigi, the she deer, Yata, as. Translation: while she was serving her husband by massaging his legs, she could feel that his feet were no longer warm and could thus understand that he had already passed from the body. She felt great anxiety upon being left alone, bereft of her husband's company. She felt exactly as the deer feels upon being separated from its mate. Purport by Srila Prabhupada. As soon as the circulation of blood and air within the body stops, it is to be understood that the soul within the body has left. The stoppage of the blood's circulation is perceived when the hands and feet lose heat. One tests whether a body is alive or not by feeling the heart's palpitations and the coldness of the feet and hands.
Omagyana timirandasya gnanjana salaka chakshuru mritam yena tasmai shri guru namah namo shuddha krishna sarvada yishu bhajavada kasvam namo
Translation again. While she was serving her husband by massaging his legs, she could feel that his feet were no longer warm and could thus understand that he had already passed from the body. She felt great anxiety upon being left alone. Bereft of her husband's company, she felt exactly as the deer feels upon being separated from its mate. For those who have joined today, we are talking about Manas Puranjana, who became, in the next life, the daughter of King Vidarbha. She became Princess Vidarbhi. And she married Maharsh Malayadvaja, a great king, a great devotee, and they were in the Vanaprastha stage of retirement. They were in the forest. Malayadvaja was meditating on the Paramatma, sitting, and basically he was such an advanced yogi that from the meditation he just left his body. The soul left his body. So Vaidarbhi was massaging the feet of the husband in silence, not to disturb his concentration, and at one point she started noticing that the feet were not as warm as usual. So she realized that the husband had left. And so this realization is sinking in, and the emotions in relation to this realization are coming up. Samvigna Ridhaya, the heart becomes agitated. She had been under shelter of her husband. There's been a stable, progressive, productive relation. And now she has to move to another phase of her life, of being a widow. And the Bhagavatam compares this to the deer who have lost its mate and feels agitated, feel loss, feel a loss, feel very full of tumultuous feelings. Now, Srila Prabhupada in the next few verses will describe this situation as, of course, it's an analogy of the disciple when the guru leaves, and there are very important, instructive messages for us, but I don't want to trespass on the next verses. What's interesting here is that this of the deer, technically it's a simile within an analogy, within an allegory, talking about forms of speech. The Bhagavatam and literature in general in human society use many figures of speech. Here, what we see here, it's a comparison. Technically, it's called a simile. The feelings of Vaidarbhi upon having lost her husband is similar to a mrigi, to a deer who also has lost its mate. Technically, this is called a simile, especially when it's introduced by yatha, just like, or in English, as. When a comparison is not introduced by as or like, it's a metaphor. The difference between a simile and a metaphor is that the simile compares. He is like a lion in battle. a metaphor, it just substitutes the two. He is a lion in battle. Like when Krishna talks to Arjuna as you, tiger among men. Obviously, he was not talking zoologically. He was just speaking as a metaphor. You are a tiger among men because you have that strength, that beauty, also that courage. If Krishna had said, "You are like a tiger among men," that would have been a simile. An analogy is a little generally a little longer. Generally, a simile, just like here, it's kind of short, just like a deer. An analogy is a construct that compares two things, and it's a very important philosophical instrument because it helps us understanding what is unknown through what is known. Upamana, in Sanskrit, is called upamana. And as I said, this is a simile within an analogy. The analogy of the king and the queen being the guru and the disciple. An analogy is very common. There are so many analogies in Bhagavad Gita. There are so many analogies in Srimad Bhagavatam. It's a very important aspect of cognition, of becoming aware. Somebody said that analogical language is the core of all cognition. Because when we learn something, we attach it to some existing knowledge. We cannot learn anything unless we attach it, compare it to some existing knowledge. So in one sense, analogical language is the, some scholar defines as the core of all cognition. At the same time, we also have to understand as teachers and as preachers that an analogy is never a proof. You cannot prove your philosophy by analogy. The analogy is an illustration. It's important as a figure of speech, and it's important in communication. Somebody said that a Western writer said that a good analogy can do the job of 3-hour discussion. Because the function of the analogy is to illustrate a point. You understand the unknown through the known. Just like here, we may kind of understand out of personal experience the feeling that a woman, a wife, can feel when the husband is gone. We may kind of, but we may not know if we are not expert in devotional service and in devotional life. We may not know how a disciple feels when the guru leaves. So through analogy, we are helped to understand the subject. And I wanted to show, now when this comes back, when the computer comes back, I wanted to show Srila Prabhupada explaining how the analogy is not a proof. In fact, in Western logic, there is a logical fallacy called proof by analogy. When you try to establish something based only on analogy, based only on similarity. Like I was reading in a book that was explaining this, how sometimes completely illogical analogies are given as support for one's idea. There was one clergyman in England around before the Second World War. For some reason, he was supporting the war. And he was giving an analogy. He said that the tree, the plant of virtues, is watered by the blood of conflict. This is a very strange analogy. I mean, why the tree of virtue should be watered by the blood of conflict? doesn't make really any sense. I mean, it would be more similar in one sense to say the plant of evil is watered by the blood of conflict. I mean, it would make more sense, no? But somehow he was using this analogy to make his point. So that's a logical fallacy. It's a proof by analogy. You just try to support and kind of invent or force a similarity about two things which have no similarity whatsoever. And Srila Prabhupada, for instance, criticizes the Mayavadi, as usual, but sometimes he criticizes them also because they use improper analogies. We have a lot of Mayavadi analogies, like we use a lot of analogies. The Mayavadi, you also use a lot of analogies. It's a common figure of speech, especially in philosophical discussions. So I just wanted to read exactly Srila Prabhupada's words on this subject. Any questions so far? Anything? Yes? Do we have a mic for the internet? Sorry.
Thank you, Prabhu.
We can't really hear. Maybe it's off, or yeah, you should speak directly in the mic.
Yeah, I was just wondering about the point that you were making about the that statement, the tree of virtue. Are you saying that's not a good analogy?
Ah.
Oh. Okay.
The author of the book I was reading was taking this as an example of a forced analogy, a very artificial analogy. In other words, again, analogy is supposed to explain when two things are different, but they have some points of similarity. Through understanding things which are supposed to be familiar with, we understand the concept that we are not familiar with. So he wanted to compare war, or the shedding of human blood in conflict, to some sort of water that waters the plant of virtue. But again, first of all, you don't water plants with blood, right? It's not. And second, it doesn't really. Why the blood of the war should improve people's virtue? I mean, it's not in our experience. Generally, when countries fight, they don't become more virtuous. They become either more aggressive, or they become more inimical. They develop a lot of resentment. So it was just a bad analogy. Okay? So Srila Prabhupada says in Chaitanya Charitamrita, the Mayavadis are fond of using the example of the water pot. Maintaining that when a pot is not filled with water, it makes a sound. Empty pot, ding. But when it is filled, it makes no sound. But are we water pots? How can we be compared to them? A good analogy utilizes as many similarities between two objects as possible. A water pot is not an active living force, but we are. Ever silent meditation may be adequate for a water pot, but not for us. Indeed, when a devotee realizes how much he has to say about Krishna, 24 hours in a day are not sufficient. It is the fool who is celebrated as long as he does not speak, but when he breaks his silence, his lack of knowledge is exposed. So there are many like that analogy, but again, these are false analogies. These are logical fallacies. It's argument by analogy, because there is no real similarity. First of all, they say, In other words, when the person is realized, doesn't produce any sound anymore. How? Because like the water pot, when it's filled, doesn't make any sound. First of all, if we analyze, the first person who produced this analogy made a sound. Therefore, so even the analogy is contradictory. Because if he was a wise, realized man, he should have not spoken this analogy. So just the very fact that the analogy exists is a mistake. And second, where is the similarity? We're not pots. We're living entities. It's more understandable that the person, when he has knowledge, he can share knowledge. Why he should keep quiet? Somebody has knowledge, he presents knowledge. So this is a logical fallacy, argument by analogy. Or when the Mayavadis say, just like a drop of water, when it goes into the ocean, kind of merges or becomes the ocean. It's not true. A drop of water remains a drop of water in the ocean. It does not become the ocean. If you put a drop of water in the Atlantic Ocean, it stays, at least can move, but is it in the Atlantic Ocean? It doesn't immediately go everywhere, Indian Ocean, Pacific Ocean. So again, it's a false analogy. But they are attractive. That's why they are used. So, back to the point that the analogy is not a proof, I wanted to read this passage. This is a letter to Satswarup Maharaj in October 1975. Srila Prabhupada is explaining, our authority is on the basis of Shastra, not analogy. Our authority is Shastra. We give analogy for the general mass of people who have no faith in Shastra. Analogy is not proof. Shastra is proof. Foolish people cannot understand or accept, so we use analogy. The conclusion is not drawn from the analogy, but from the Shastra. We don't use a combination of logic and authority. We use authority. Logic we use to convince someone who does not accept the authority. The basic principle is authority. The logic of using analogy is called in the Shastra Shakachandranyaya. The logic of the moon through the branches of a tree. It is easier to focus on the moon through the branches of a tree. The moon is great distance away, and you say that it is just through the branches. So you can focus more easily on the moon because two points join make a straight line. So focusing on the nearby object helps us to focus on the faraway object. This is the use of analogy. Is it clear? And Srila Prabhupada explains this through an analogy. It's like you have the moon in the sky, but there is a tree, and you say, look at the tree, and then you see the moon. The object is the moon, but you use the tree as a pointer. And again, as I was saying, so this is of the deer is a simile within an analogy, which is within an allegory. What is an allegory? An allegory is an extended analogy. It's a narrative based on the use of similarity, analogies, and symbols. The whole story of King Puranjana, it's an allegory. It's an allegorical description of a king, Puranjana, who is actually the soul, who lived in his city, which actually is the body, and we actually had a wife, which actually the mind. And if you study the whole analogy, the whole allegory, it's a whole history of the soul, his attachment, his relation with time, old age, his being born again, and so on. So So this is used in Vaishnava philosophy, especially here. Let's remember that is Narada Muni telling this old story to Maharaj Prachinabhrishat, which was a materialistic king. He was fond of doing animal sacrifices. He was we could call it a karmi, a Vedic karmi, but nonetheless a karmi. So Narada Muni, to kind of reawaken his consciousness, he speaks about things in an indirect way. When Narada Muni preaches to Vyasadeva in the first canto, or Yudhisthira Maharaj in the first canto, it uses a little analogy, but just as an illustration. It doesn't get into the whole allegorical description, because they're qualified, they can get the message straight. But again, analogy is not a proof, but it's very useful. And therefore, there are many, many forms of analogical language. In the English language, we had discussed a little bit about simile, we have mentioned about metaphor. There is another form which is called synecdoche. I know many of you are familiar. Synecdoche means referring to an object by referring to part of it. Like when you call a car wheels. Let me check your wheels. Like that. And it's very common. You call a man like red beard. He obviously has much more than a red beard. But because that's like a characteristic, you say, oh, the red beard has come. Obviously, it's not a beard came by itself. So that's technically called a synecdoche. There's another figure of speech called metonymy. Metonymy is when you refer to something by calling it something in relation to it. Like, for instance, when you say the White House issued a press report. Now, obviously, it's not the White House, it's not a building in Washington that issue anything. It's a building, it's a house. White House meaning the staff of the President of the United States of America. So all these actually are very common in our daily speech, in journalism, in literature, English literature, Sanskrit literature, but they have specific terms, and perhaps there is some use in understanding, no? When you're using a simile, when you use a metaphor, when you use a synecdoche, or any other forms of speech. Any questions or comments? Yes. Do you want to use the mic?
How can we differentiate between an analogy that guides us towards truth rather than one that guides us away from it, like the example with the tree being watered by blood?
Well, you have to see, first of all, you can see the source. Some are Krishna himself speaks. Like he says, the yogi controls the senses by withdrawing the senses from the sense objects, just like a tortoise withdraws its limb inside the body. It's a perfect analogy. And it gives really a good image. Because we know turtles, we know tortoises, how they do. They close themselves. So we understand the yogi, it withdraws his senses. Of course, it doesn't withdraw them inside the body, but it withdraws it from the object of the senses. So there are many beautiful, powerful analogies given by Krishna himself, or by the acharyas themselves. So those you kind of you play it safe when you use those. And some are traditional and some are new. Like for instance, Srila Prabhupada in the second canto uses a non-traditional analogy. He says that the very advanced devotee can see the pastimes of the Lord in Vaikuntha just like a spiritual television. This was not an analogy that the previous acharyas in the Middle Ages were using, because there was no television. So Srila Prabhupada used, but we know what television is. We know it's an instrument, you can see images from very far, and you can see it in front of you. So by the analogy, of a television, we can understand, oh, okay, the heart of a devotee becomes like a television of the spiritual world. So, the first part of the answer is that you see the source. If it comes from Shastra, if it comes from Acharyas, you can take them as bona fide, and you can use them, using the proper context. And then you can analyze. You can create your own analogies. There's no moratorium on analogies, but you should be careful that really give the proper meaning. And again, you use them as an illustration, not as a proof. Otherwise it would be illogical. Like, you cannot prove that the soul, we are not a body, by saying that the soul is like a bird in a cage. It's not a proof. I mean, there are birds in cages, and we understand that birds in a cage work in a certain way, and we can say the soul is like a cage in the body. But it's an illustration, it's not a proof. You can prove we are souls. You see, there are birds in the cage, therefore we are souls. It's not logical. It's not logical. So when you use it, you have to use it properly, otherwise you misrepresent the message. Yes. Okay? Okay? Yeah, we have him, and then you probably.
Hare Krishna Prabhu. You were mentioning about separation of guru again in class today, comparing it to yesterday's verse. And I just wanted to know if you could elaborate on that a little bit. You said specifically disciple in absence.
Yeah, as I said, I didn't want to elaborate because in the next few days there will be elaboration in the verses and in the Srila Prabhupada's purport. Yeah, it's natural that the disciple feels separation when the guru... I mean, it's natural, it's healthy. These feelings are healthy feelings. These are not material feelings. If the guru has left this world, the disciple should feel separation. The right way of feeling separation is to become more absorbed in the instructions, more absorbed in the mission of the guru. Like that. It shouldn't be just something sentimental that it manifests in a decrease determination, in a decrease commitment to the guru. You had any particular aspect in mind? Yeah, see, talking about another figure of speech, proverbs. Sometimes proverbs, they are, or again, illustrations of a principle, but often they are illustrations of a part of a truth. Like, there is a saying that the heart grows fonder. Was that in distance? The heart grows fonder? What's the English?
Absence.
Huh?
Absence makes the heart.
Yeah. The absence makes the heart grow fonder. And this is what should happen in this connection. But there is also a saying that says, out of sight, out of mind. Actually, I have the whole presentation on this polarity and the number of sayings which contain some wisdom, but not the full wisdom, because you cannot just apply. So, for somebody, it may happen, not out of sight, out of mind, that the guru comes, there's a lot of enthusiasm, there are ceremonies, rituals, he's present, we feel enthusiasm, and he goes, it's kind of out of sight, out of mind. But it should be the other way around, no? That separation makes the heart grow fonder. It intensifies the attachment. Because there is not only the attachment, but there is also the sense of missing the person. Like that. But it's about the quality of the disciple. I mean, I can... can see, I'll give you an example. I've been serving as time as secretary to my spiritual master occasionally, and I see sometimes there are people who are very far, physically very far. They live in a different continent. But somehow, either they're always engaged in some service to the spiritual master, personal service, or when they are, say, in Mayapur, they really do their best to get to stay close to the spiritual master. I remember one new devotee, he was not even initiated in London. Some, I don't know, cool deep, one Indian, nice. Somehow, although he was not initiated, when he would be in Mayapur, he would always stay with Japtaka Maharaj. No? He would manage to always stay with what he considered his spiritual master. No? But sometimes I see in Mayapur itself, maybe the guru is there, he gives Bhagavatam class, and some disciples don't even go. So the distance, it's a relative. No? Some people are very absorbed. They may be here, the guru may be in India, but they absorb, they listen to class, they meditate, they take note, they pray. And some people may be right there, but they're spaced out, they look here and there. It's entirely possible. It's entirely possible. So here, especially in the next few verses, you will learn these feelings and this... the situation when the guru leaves the body, how the disciples should, or even when the guru just leaves the country or the city, like that. There was a point.
I was just wondering for persons who do not accept the authority of Shastra, which is the actual proof or evidence that we could use, then what would be the use in trying to explain to them anything by illustration? Because ultimately, if it not be a proof, then they're going to ask us, what's our proof? And then we have to refer to Shastra, an authority which they don't accept.
Yeah, but again, when you present the concept that they're not familiar with, if there is enough similarity, they can be convinced, or at least they can be... they can say, yeah, if it works in this situation, may also work in the other situation. I give you an example. The concept of Achintya Bheda Bheda Tattva. God is simultaneously and inconceivably different and non-different from anything else. Because everything which exists is energy. Now, somebody may say, what does it mean? Beda, beda is different, non-different. What does it mean, you know? So you may give the analogy of the spider, which is given 2-3 times in the Bhagavatam. The spider emanates, produces this its web, and it produces from its own body. So the spider web is simultaneously non-different from the spider, because it's come from the spider. At the same time, it's different from the spider. Spider web and a spider are different. But at the same time, they're not different. So you, even in this world, you have something which is simultaneously different and non-different. Yogurt and milk. One may think, why Shiva, Vishnu, are they different? Are they not different? Well, Vishnu is like the milk. Shiva is like the yogurt. The milk can become yogurt. Vishnu, Narayan, can become Shiva. But Shiva cannot become back Narayan. So just like yogurt is milk, but yogurt cannot become milk back. So it's not a proof, but people can, yeah, it's true. Yeah, yogurt is milk, but cannot become milk again. So Shiva is a form of God, but particularly for the material world, so is not the original God. Something like that. It's a help to understand. Of course, somebody doesn't want to understand, there's nothing more or less you can do. But if there is a dialogue, the person is open just a little bit, just because... it's just not familiar with the concept. which is not familiar with the concept. So you help. There's so many analogies. Like the analogy in the Bhagavad Gita, I believe it's in the purport of Bhagavad Gita, the analogy of the scorpion laying eggs in the rice. Of course, many of these are from a rural type of environment. We may, no, like city boys and girls may not really know, but the analogy says, just like in the rice, you have a pile of rice, and sometimes you see scorpions coming out. So ignorant people think that the scorpions come from rice, but then people in knowledge know that they're coming from eggs, from scorpion eggs inside the rice. They don't come from the rice. So the analogy is that we see living entities coming out of Prakriti, but actually they're not made of Prakriti. They don't come from Prakriti. They come because of the glance of the Lord, because the Lord injects the jivas within Prakriti, and so they come up as living entity. I mean, we could go on and on and on with analogies, but it helps. If somebody is a little open, it helps understanding. Yeah, just like we see this apparent thing, the scorpion coming rise, we understand that, oh, we apparently made of matter, but we are not matter. We don't come from matter like that. And at one point you got to explain that there are different sources of knowledge. In Western philosophy, it's called epistemology. It's basically, how do you know what you know? What are the sources of your knowledge? And the validity of those sources. This is, at least in Indian philosophy, any Indian philosophy, is the first topic. Pramana. No, what is your pramana? How do you get to know this thing? So, Vedanta Sutra, and there are different pramanas. There are about like 10 traditional pramanas. We accept 3 mainly. But the main pramana is Shastra, revelation. That's the pramana. And we see Vedanta Sutra says, it starts with Atato Brahma Jigyasa. Now you have to inquire into Brahman. You have to inquire into the Absolute Truth. Then defines, what is this Absolute Truth? Jammadi Asya Yataha. That Absolute Truth is that from which creation, maintenance, and destruction of the universe come from. And then the next question is, okay, how do I know that Absolute Truth? Shastra Yunitvat. You will know from Shastra, not from logic, not from sense perception. Madhvacharya explained, Srila Madhvacharya explained, through logic you can prove that the truth is falsity and the falsity is true, just by manipulation of words. That's not a proof. So Shastra Yunitvat. And because the Shastra says so many things, Tattu Samamvayat, next sutra says you have to reconcile. You have to do the Samamvaya. You have to reconcile the statements of the Shastra. Like that. Any more questions or comments?
Sure. Analogies are also very helpful for the things that are particularly difficult for us to understand, for things that are beyond our experience, are new to us, or in the case of understanding the divine, to try to understand things to help us get beyond our material experiences, our sense experiences. And would you say, is that true in the, and there are a lot of analogies used in the Shastra?
I don't know, because something that comes to mind is this. Von Neumann. Yeah, maybe you can repeat in the mic. You speak like this in the mic in front.
Well, I'm speaking a little bit from an English teacher background, but analogies being used to explain things that are difficult for us to understand. And if that is true also in our understanding of Krishna.
Okay, we need to step back and say, what means understanding? What is understanding? What we understand? What does it mean to understand something, to grasp something? Which, by the way, it's a metaphor, not to grasp something. One Indian gentleman last year, he was saying, it's a common saying in India, he said, he was very dramatic, you know, he would say, do you know what understanding means? Understanding means standing under. So in other words, shouldn't take it too technically, but in one sense it's true. You stand under, you accept, you get accustomed to an idea and you accept that idea as reality. That's understanding. Von Neumann, he was a famous mathematician from Hungary, famous for those who are into mathematics. There was a story, he was a professor in the university, and a student went to him and said, Professor, I don't understand how this mathematical equation works. And he looked at the student and said, son, in mathematics, you don't understand things. You just get accustomed to them. So, that's why I was saying, somebody says that analogy or analogical language is the core of all cognition. We just get accustomed to a certain picture of reality, to a certain map of reality. And then it's more psychologically really than cognitive. No, I mean, it's almost emotional. We get accustomed to a picture and we can get comfortable. We need cognitive stability. We need to know certain things. That's why denial is so powerful. No? One can just deny things. The mind can accept anything. There are people who say, just to use the same example, there are people whose husband has died 20 years ago, they don't accept that the husband has died. The mind can conjure up anything. The lady, the husband is dead 20 years ago, she understands that the husband is alive. So the mind can actually accept or reject anything. Just to give you, you know this cartoon comics, Asterix the Gaul, the French barbarian. So there was a story, Asterix and Obelix. Sorry to give this analogy, but no, this Asterix is the short one, Obelix is the big one, no? So they go to Getafix, which is the druid, like the magician of the village. And the druid gives them a special seeds. When you throw the seeds on the ground, a tree immediately grows, a big tree grows. So Obelix, which is kind of slow, no, is a very slow person. It's not very acute, very alert. So Asterisk used this seed, puts a seed on the ground, and boom, immediately a big tree appears. And Asterix is very surprised. Look, Obelix, look how fast it grows. But Obelix was completely indifferent. And then he said, I don't know how fast the trees grow. Because, in other words, for him, he saw this tree growing immediately in front of him, but he said, I don't know how fast the trees grow. He didn't make the relation that this was fast. So the world is full of mystical things, but we just become accustomed and we understand. We understand how we eat or we digest. We understand sleep. We understand growth. We don't understand. We just become accustomed to it. So the idea, in one sense, it just become accustomed to some ideas of reality. Do we grasp really anything? That's my question. You follow? So sometimes what I'm trying to say is, what we call understanding is just that we became habituated, accustomed to something. Not necessarily we understand. It's just experience. Do we understand? Can you explain why we feel tired at night and why we feel refreshed in the morning? Can you explain to me? Do we understand?
Somewhat,
but it's more of a faith than really understanding. We heard that and we accept it. Okay, the cells need some rest, or the brain needs some rest, but we don't really understand what's happening. You know, we don't really understand. Sometimes we dream so much, we should be more tired. No, our brain should be more tired in the morning than not in the day. I mean, in one sense. But okay, we sleep, we have dreams, and we get up, we're fresh. So, in other words, to start addressing your question, the real question is, what does it mean, understanding? So understanding means standing under. You stand under a conception, and you accept that conception. And you're comfortable with that conception. But we accept pratyaksha, anumana, and shabda. We accept direct perception as a source of knowledge. We accept logic as a source of knowledge. But there are more than that, we accept shabda as infallible revelation, because sense perception is only based on the senses, which are imperfect. Logic is also based on imperfect senses. Shabda is beyond. Last question or comment? So, to conclude, this is the whole process of understanding. We are in an allegory, which have dozens of analogies, and some of these analogies, like in this one, there's even a simile to help us understand. So we try to understand, we try to grasp the similarity, things which we are familiar with, so we can apply to things which we may not be familiar with. Thank you very much for your attention. Grantara Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai, Srila Prabhupada ki jai.